Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And we're jumping back into our sort of focus on criminal law that we've been pursuing the last few weeks. And our guest today is Michael Falkenberg, who's the supervising attorney at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. And maybe the name that came up from pretty much every criminal guest we've had on and said, this is the guy you need to talk to. He knows a lot about a lot. So we're really excited to have him on. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm a loyal listener and fan of the show. Longtime listener, first time caller.
We're really glad you're here. For our listeners out there, kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got where you are.
Sure. I grew up in Seguin, just south of San Marcos, near San Antonio. I went to undergrad at a small liberal arts school called Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania. And I came back after that because I had a liberal arts degree, which I very much enjoyed. I knew I wanted to go back to school for something, but I didn't know it could have been history or philosophy or literature or whatever. I like all that stuff. And I ended up working in a record store for 5 years. While I was an undergrad, I was a DJ on the school's radio station, which is sort of all I did, really, to be honest with you. I was truly a slacker in San Marcos for 5 years. And at some point, I decided I've got to go back to school. I've got to do something. And law school had always been in the back of my mind. And I thought, what the heck? Nothing ventured, nothing gained. I didn't really know much about it. I just thought it seemed like the kind of thing that would be good for me. And I went to St. Mary's in San Antonio, and it was one of the best things I ever did in my life. I was a guy in law school who liked every class. I loved mortgages. I loved all the constitutional classes. I enjoyed secured transactions. I liked property. I would love to be a contracts professor. That would be great. But I wanted to be involved in constitutional law litigation, and I've always liked the idea of being a criminal defense lawyer, but I didn't have the guts to hang out my own shingle and deal with all the uncertainty and pay back law school loans and all that. And so I found an office that's a public defender office in Huntsville. It's been around for a long time. A lot of people don't know about it. It's called State Counsel for Offenders. And what they do is they defend prisoners who are charged with committing new crimes while they're in prison. And so those cases happen in the county of where they're living in prison. So Brazoria County, Coryell County, you go all over the state. Tennessee Colony, I forget which county that is. Bowie County, all over the place. And you defend these cases that occur in prison, whether it's an assault or they've got drugs. For a while, having a cell phone was illegal. I don't know the status of that. And they were all third-degree felonies. And so these guys were all looking at serious time because you've got a felony conviction if you're in prison, so you've got enhancements. So a lot of times we're looking at habitual offender enhancements, which is 25 to life is the best you can do for an assault or a dope charge. Or some of them were very serious, of course, murders and escapes and that sort of thing. So you get to see all kinds of wild stuff. But that was only part of what the office did. They were also tasked with doing these civil trials. They're called civil commitment of sexually violent predators. So if you are someone with two sex offenses, you are subject to being sued in civil court under the civil rules, and the state is essentially proving that you are a sexually violent predator. For a time, all those cases were in Montgomery County. You might have seen some of these on the Supreme Court docket. They pop up from time to time. So these are level three discovery trials. While I was there in Montgomery County, all the appeals went to Beaumont. And so that's a big docket. A lot of cases, a lot of appeals. And then finally, we did immigration work. These are the things I was involved in. And that's mainly looking into somebody's case. And they have an immigration court on the Goree in Huntsville. And so they bust these guys in from all over the state for immigration court. You've got a criminal conviction, you're subject in most cases to removal. So we would sort of screen those cases and find guys who may have been born in the states or have some kind of defense. There aren't many. Chances are if you've got a felony conviction and you're not a citizen, you're out. But we sort of screened those and went to court on a select few. You have a lot of exposure to a lot of different things. And when you start there, they shuffle you through all of those sections. And I knew that I wanted to be an appellate lawyer. And so I was there. And it's the kind of thing that most people don't start out their career wanting to do appeal work. So there was a lot of things open to me. I was able to focus on that immediately and say, this is what I want to do. I got to work on a cert petition in my first year. We had a lot of judges that we thought were treating us badly. From my classes with Professor Flynn at St. Mary's, I knew all about mandamus. And so we were able to win some mandamus cases. We were able to shut down some things we weren't happy with that trial judges were doing. And so it was really cool. It was a really great experience. You learn a lot about the prison system, which is something that most workaday defense lawyers, once their case is over, it's over. And there's a whole other side of things that happens in prison. So it was an office that I'd actually learned about while interning on central staff at the Court of Criminal Appeals. And so that was a great experience for me. I worked there for 4 years. And at some point, I thought I want to move back to be closer to my family and get a wider variety of experience, because after a while, all the cases were very similar. Prisoners don't have Fourth Amendment rights. So you know, if somebody sees a bag of drugs in the cell, you can't say that they didn't have a warrant or whatever. So it was kind of a limited set of issues that you could raise. And I felt like I'd learned the best I could learn, the most things I could learn from that. So I started looking to get in with courts to try and learn more. And I ended up coming back to central staff at the Court of Criminal Appeals, which is where I've been since 2008.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. The Court of Criminal Appeals is a little different than the Supreme Court in that it has the central staff. How does that kind of work? Do the judges have chambers attorneys and they have central staff?
That's right. Each judge has two lawyers, a permanent lawyer and young lawyers straight out of law school most of the time. And those lawyers work for generally for a year, sometimes two or three. Judge Womack, who's on the court when I started there, would just have lawyers work for 2 years. And he always had two new lawyers. But most judges have a permanent lawyer that works in their chambers. But we also have the central staff, which has three sections. We've got a general counsel. There's the section that I work in. I'm the supervising lawyer of the writ section. There's seven of us in that. There's four people in the death penalty section, and there's five people in the PDR section. And I'll explain that a little bit more. The Court of Criminal Appeals has a significant, what we call a mandatory docket. Most lawyers who aren't appellate specialists think about high courts in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court or the Texas Supreme Court, and based on the opinions that they hand down. The Court of Criminal Appeals definitely does that. But in addition to that, they have, that's sort of the tip of the iceberg. 81% of their docket is what we call the mandatory docket. These are cases that the court, either by statute or by maybe by constitution, has to deal with as a matter of first instance. And so the central staff helps the court process that volume of cases, helps the court make initial decisions on all of those cases. So I can explain that more.
Please.
The petitions for discretionary review are what a lot of appellate lawyers are most familiar with. These are discretionary review of appellate court opinions in direct appeal cases for the most part. And so that's the discretionary docket. And so we have lawyers who just go through all of those and make recommendations to the court about whether to take the case or not to take the case. But on top of that, we have the habeas corpus system is complicated, but what's less complicated is post-conviction habeas corpus applications in felony cases. So these are what we call collateral attacks, maybe like a bill of review. I don't remember very well, but it's a collateral attack on the judgment, technically a new lawsuit. By statute, those are filed in the trial court. The trial court may or may not do some fact-finding on them, and then they all get shipped to the Court of Criminal Appeals. So we get these from all 254 counties challenging final felony convictions. So these are prisoners who are in prison. Last I checked, we still have over 100,000 people locked up in Texas. Not many of them are happy to be there. And they don't have a right to a lawyer for this process. So they're filing these, for the most part, pro se. And so we get about 4,000 a year. This last fiscal year, they were down a little bit. But for reasons I may or may not get into, that litigation is a little bit more complicated now. So we are helping the court sort through those 4,000, 3,800, whatever, applications that we get from the counties. And it's sort of like, I don't know if this is exactly right, but we're sort of reviewing them for summary judgment, kind of like, have they alleged facts, which this is the most important principle. You got to allege facts, which if true would entitle you to relief. If they have, then we need to have fact finding on it. Maybe the trial court has already done that, or maybe the court needs to ship it back to the trial court. So if you look at the Court of Criminal Appeals hand down every week, there's cases that are remanded to the trial court to sort out what this person is alleging.
If I can stop you for a sec, sorry, just for what kind of stuff gets alleged in that? I mean, what are types of things that come up in these writs a lot that you see?
Sure. So I'll backtrack a little bit. Habeas corpus is a big concept. It's been around for 800 years. The bottom line of habeas corpus is you're holding me, you're restraining me, give a good reason for it, justify that. That concept is now spread through the entire criminal process. So there's pretrial writs of habeas corpus where you may raise a facial challenge to a statute. There's bail writs if you're held for no bail or high bail. If you're an overzealous lawyer, or if the judge thinks you're overzealous and you get held in contempt of court, habeas corpus is your remedy. So then post-conviction habeas corpus is what I was talking about. That's the collateral attack on the judgment. So in a traditional appeal, as appellate lawyers know, you're limited to what is in the record, the objections that were made on the record, the arguments that were made on the record. Post-conviction habeas is for things, for constitutional issues mostly, that are from outside the record, that require further development of the record, that you couldn't have known about at trial. So the Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel is the number one claim. You don't see a lot of malpractice suits on the criminal side, but you do see lots of ineffective assistance of counsel claims. My counsel screwed up, and because of that error, the validity of my conviction is in question. Brady versus Maryland violations. That's the case that says that the state has to hand over exculpatory evidence in discovery. Until recently, that was really the only discovery you might get if you were representing the citizen accused, was Brady evidence. If it turns out that they didn't give you something exculpatory, that could be a viable habeas corpus claim post-conviction, because obviously that wouldn't have been something that went down on the record for direct appeal. Actual innocence, Texas has been a leader in actual innocence until the 90s. That wasn't something that we were concerned about. It literally was not something for habeas corpus. If you've got newly discovered evidence, do something else. Go for clemency, go for a pardon. That's your remedy. Since the mid-90s, Texas has recognized that actual innocence is a due process claim that you can raise. So if you have new evidence that shows I didn't really do this, then you have a higher burden than most of the other cases, but that's something that you can litigate. And a lot of people have. You may see the upshot from this on the Supreme Court docket because of their exclusive mandamus jurisdiction over executive officials. Sometimes these show up on their mandamus docket if the comptroller won't pay compensation, because you're now entitled to compensation if you have a winning actual innocence claim. So actual innocence is a claim that the federal courts still don't recognize, but we've been doing it in Texas since the late 90s. That's another claim. So these things, false evidence is something else where the state has been a leader. If the court held in the mid-2000s that if false evidence was presented at trial that turns out to be false, it doesn't matter whether there was intent in that, doesn't matter whether it was perjured, we just care, and this makes sense, we care that there was false evidence that contributed to a conviction. That's a viable claim on post-conviction habeas. So it's these sort of things that are from outside of the record that you couldn't have done at trial. But by the same token, you can't raise Fourth Amendment claims because you should have raised that. You can't raise things that you could have raised at trial. And that's part of what we're sorting out on central staff are things that are cognizable on habeas corpus, to use that word, or things that aren't. A lot of times, because we're dealing with pro se litigants and some lawyers, they raise a bunch of stuff that just doesn't matter.
You mentioned the difference between federal and state habeas. What is the source? I think it's statutory. 11 point something, I guess. Is it in the Code of Criminal Procedure? Or what's the source of whatever right there is to habeas corpus in Texas?
The Texas Constitution grants the Court of Criminal Appeals plenary habeas corpus jurisdiction. It extends beyond the criminal side, although they don't normally get involved in civil things. That's recodified in the Code of Criminal Procedure. Then Chapter 11 of the Code of Criminal Procedure divides up all these different uses for habeas corpus and says that you file this kind of thing here, you file this kind of thing here. So 1107 controls post-conviction felony habeas corpus. 1107.1 is death penalty habeas corpus, which that comes straight to the court. And then there's other situations for if you had a misdemeanor conviction, if you're on community supervision for something, there are other ways to do it. And those are all in Chapter 11 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. I believe also that district judges have constitutional habeas corpus jurisdiction. I don't quote me on that, but I think that they might. It's sort of part of our job, part of knowing the technicalities is what isn't covered. They're sort of gap-filling jurisdiction because our court system is so complex. There's little things where it may be that a district judge has jurisdiction. It may be that the Court of Appeals does. So it's pretty complicated. Just like in the Texas court system, it seems like nothing is straightforward. Habeas corpus is one of those things.
Sometimes you hear in the media cases of, say, DNA evidence that wasn't available 25 years ago, and someone was convicted of a crime, and this new evidence comes forward. Is habeas the mechanism then for presenting that sort of issue to the courts?
That's right. Chapter 64 of the Code of Criminal Procedure provides the method by which a prisoner could get new DNA testing or DNA testing in the first instance. And so that's a separate how to do it and how to get it done. There's a mechanism for that. Once you've got it done, if that is exculpatory and it's something that wasn't around at the time of the conviction, then it's habeas corpus is going to be the remedy, whether it proves your innocence or it goes to some other claim. Maybe the technology was there and the lawyer didn't get it done. Maybe it's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. But yes, that's how, when there's a DNA evidence that comes out, chances are that it's going to be habeas. It's going to be the remedy to actually make something happen with that conviction.
Have you seen more of those actual innocence type claims in the last decade or so? I feel like as science has kind of caught up with a lot of this stuff and as they've kind of changed forensic science and all that kind of stuff, do you see more of those now?
We've seen quite a few, but I think there was a real wave earlier on that I wasn't around at the court for when some places had kept a lot of evidence. So some district attorney's offices still had evidence from 30 and 40 years ago. Some don't. And so there was a wave of DNA testing went on when that technology became more prevalent, more accessible. And I think that there was a wave of exonerations at that point. A lot of them are from Dallas County, not necessarily because of anything they do in Dallas County, but just because they had boxes and boxes of old evidence that was susceptible to retesting. We see a lot of false evidence claims, changing science. A lot of times changing science is something that plays a part in a conviction. Maybe there was something else in there that was, it's not completely exculpatory. It doesn't totally exonerate somebody, But it does cast a doubt on the conviction enough to where we want to try it again. We want to start over on that. But it's not completely exculpatory. And we've seen a lot of that, and the court has wrestled with how to deal with changing scientific opinions. You'll get psychologists and psychiatrists who are saying, I wouldn't have said that, or forensic scientists, people who do autopsies, saying the science has changed in the last 20 years. I wouldn't have testified to this. And it may be that a cause of death just becomes undetermined. And so then the question is, how significant was that to the trial? So it's like a harm analysis that you're going to be used to in any appeal, but we're just applying it. Sometimes I describe to people, I'm kind of like someone who does autopsies on criminal convictions to see what really mattered. Maybe this person had comorbidities. What killed the patient? We're trying to sort that out.
That's fascinating.
You see, you know, I know that a lot of in the bigger cities, certainly the DA's offices have started getting these conviction integrity units that kind of do look backs and look forwards. Do you see them playing a role in this process more often now?
Oh, yes. And they've been growing. More and more jurisdictions have them. And I think I can't speak for them. I think that the idea is that they take a less adversarial approach to reexamining convictions and are more open to working with the other parties. But with that said, sometimes they're going to be in a position where they're just saying, we can't agree to this. This is a good conviction.
Sure.
This guy was good for it. But I think that it's meant to be more collaborative, and that's their focus. And maybe they are separated from the line prosecutors and the line appellate prosecutors in the chain of command in a police shop, like an internal investigation unit. I haven't served in one. I've had some friends who work in some. So I don't know if that's all entirely accurate, but I think that's the general idea, is that it's just meant to be more collaborative when that's possible.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
I want to go back to your explanation of mandatory versus discretionary, the docket, for just a second, because I think the way you explain that maybe helps me understand, and Jody, chime in on this, but I always wondered why the subsequent history in case law on the civil side was just petition for review, pet denied would be the subsequent history. And in criminal cases, it wasn't just a petition for review, it was a petition for discretionary review. And I think the way you explained it just now helps me understand the difference in the word. That's not just some random happenstance language that wasn't used intentionally to distinguish between the types of petitions being brought to the different courts. Does that make sense?
I think it does. Do you, Jody?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, there's a lot more of the Court of Criminal Appeals docket that's mandatory rather than discretionary, where pretty much everything at the Texas Supreme Court is just discretionary.
Right. And so for this little civil appellate lawyer over here who always wondered why the criminal cases had that extra word in their subsequent history, I think that you just cleared it up for me. I had this sort of odd epiphany that I thought I would just verify with you guys.
Well, and you know, the real old timers will know that these things have had different names over the years. I mean, didn't it used to be a writ of error or something like that? It sort of changes. And then I think on the civil side, the precedential value of these things changes or makes a difference based, or used to maybe, based on certain verbiage, but I don't remember that exactly. I don't have my green book on me. The mandatory docket also includes mandamus and the other things that the criminal appeals has constitutional jurisdiction over. So theoretically, technically, we have certiorari jurisdiction, procedendo jurisdiction, prohibition jurisdiction. And so these are all things they, in the cases, you see them referred to as discretionary writs, which is something I haven't always totally understood. I've looked into it a little bit, but they're mandatory insofar as we don't choose them. they come to the court and the court has to decide them one way or the other. It has to grant or deny or whatever.
Well, you really, now I've piqued my interest talking about mandamus in the criminal context. Mm-hmm. What does that look like in your court in particular, or just criminal law generally?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question if you're a real appellate litigator, because as you guys know, on the civil side, mandamus law is very well developed. It's a regular part of appellate CLEs. It's something that you've got to have in your toolkit if you're an appellate lawyer on the civil side, because the Supreme Court has, as far as I can tell, endorsed its use and indeed lowered the burden, lowered it from where it was 30 or 40 years ago, maybe. On the criminal side, I mean, there's theories about what the court is happy with and what it's not happy with and what it's willing to tolerate and what it's willing to get to intervene in. But you also have lots more litigation before trial than on the criminal side. There's whole years of discovery and all that. On the criminal side, you tend to get practitioners still think of it in the old school way where it's got to be a ministerial duty and no adequate remedy. And so they think of it in a much more conscripted way than they do on the civil side. We're still not to abuse of discretion, but the Court of Criminal Appeals has loosened it up a little bit. And in fact, about 10 years ago, I want to say, they got involved in a capital murder case in Huntsville and got involved in the jury instructions. In a pending trial, the judge had to excuse the jury and wait for mandamus decisions, first from Waco and then from the Court of Criminal Appeals. And the Court of Criminal Appeals granted mandamus relief. And I don't think that a lot of people noticed that on the criminal side, and they didn't think much about it. But that was, I thought, a big expansion of what they had done before. We see a lot of mandamuses from just the, like, habeas corpus that I was talking about is on a statutory timetable in the trial courts. So we get things all the time saying the district clerk hasn't forwarded the writ. We abate those things for responses. That's sort of classic mandamus. But now that there's more discovery on the criminal side, and I think people are sort of waking up to the tool that it can be, we've seen more mandamus litigation over the past 10 years since I've been there. And the court has been willing to look at these things and get involved in them more than they probably would have 15 or 20 years ago. So it's changing, but I don't know if everybody really recognizes that it's changing. But I also don't know that people really understand how much different it is on the civil side. So it's one of those things where we're like two ships passing in the night in our system, because we don't read each other's opinions for the most part. But it is changing, and people are getting tuned into what a fruitful thing it can be. And particularly prosecutors, because a lot of times they don't have an appellate remedy. And so there was some question when the Court of Criminal Appeals got mandamus jurisdiction back in the, or it got wider mandamus jurisdiction back when they expanded the appellate courts. I think it was in the early 80s, maybe the late 70s. There was questions about whether, because prosecutors didn't have any right to appeal, whether they should have a right to a mandamus either. But that's water under the bridge. That never really got anywhere. And they find it most useful, I think. Criminal defense lawyers are starting to pick up on it a little bit.
Well, a mandamus on a jury instruction starts to sound an awful lot like what we do in the civil context.
Right. They haven't gone that far since.
We don't see that really on jury charges, but we see it in a lot of other, what might be considered sort of incidental or certainly interlocutory trial court rulings.
Interlocutory.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like what you're saying makes sense, that it's starting to creep more toward the civil standard, which will be interesting to watch.
How does the Court of Criminal Appeals use certiorari?
It doesn't. There are a few things like certiorari and procedendo that are sort of dead letters at the moment. Technically, I have to look this up about once a year, and it's been a year since I did it. But I think that basically the case says that certiorari is not applicable when you have an appellate right. Maybe even when you've waived an appellate right. If you had an appellate right, you don't have a certiorari right. In reality, it's just not. It's whatever function it might serve is covered by some other criminal process. But it's there in the Constitution, Article 5, Section 5, maybe, I don't know. lists all the Court of Criminal Appeals extraordinary writ jurisdiction. That one, like mandamus and like the others, are limited for the Court of Criminal Appeals to criminal law matters. And so sometimes there's a question whether this is a criminal law matter or not. And sometimes the court will punt on that. If it's garnishment of court costs from an inmate trust account, is that a criminal law matter? I think probably not, but there's a case on that. So we do have to think about that from time to time, but that's not a limitation that applies to the habeas corpus jurisdiction.
Interesting.
The CCA has this whole other world that you only really see on the handout when there's a long list of things that were denied or that were remanded or that baited, that sort of takes 17 lawyers to help them deal with in addition to their chambers. We do go to conference on these things, which is different from other courts. We're not there for opinion conferences, but we are there for the basic decisions on PDRs and writs and mandamuses. So that's a little bit unique as well.
Do the writs get oral argument typically, or is it something that doesn't happen very often?
It doesn't happen very often. What happens is if the court does write a published opinion, it takes it to another level. They file and set it. So theoretically, writs aren't filed, they're received. So at some point, if a writ raises an issue that they need to resolve with a written opinion for whatever reason, then it'll be filed and set, and then it moves into the world of the chambers. And they may or may not set it for oral argument. And a lot of times they're based on pure legal issues and it's not a complicated record. So a lot of times there is an oral argument, but there is from time to time. And I try and go down for those when they do happen. Interestingly or not, related to our just prior discussion, in the last year, the Court of Criminal Appeals handed down more published mandamus opinions than it 1107 habeas corpus opinion. So
interesting.
Maybe a changing sign of the times. I don't know.
Writs are a little bit different and kind of outside the system. I mean, how are they typically disposed if they're not denied? I guess what I mean is procedurally, assume you grant a writ or remand, like what happens after that?
The prisoner is returned to face the indictment. So the indictment is basically revived and you start from the beginning. Sometimes if it was just an issue related to punishment, the court will just vacate the punishment and send them back for a new punishment hearing. And sometimes if it's a double jeopardy issue, they may just zap. If they're suffering multiple punishments, the court may just zap one of those convictions and that's the end of it, but the prisoner's still being held by something else. But typically they return to face the indictment, so they start over.
When the conviction is zapped, that's a dismissal of the indictment?
I think the conviction is just vacated.
Vacates the conviction.
And the indictment is a dead letter, I think. I haven't really had to deal with that, but it is a situation where sometimes when I was representing guys, I actually didn't file any writs. But sometimes you're in a situation where you say, look, you might not want to win. You might not want to go back and do this over. You might want to think about being happy with what you've got, even though it seems like a bad deal now. It could get a lot worse.
Sure.
You may win the battle and lose the war.
We have to give that advice on the civil side all the time.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Do you want a new trial? Ask yourself that question.
Let's talk about this.
So a judgment of acquittal, then that comes up on the merits appeal, it sounds like. And then on the habeas side, what they're doing is just putting everything back where it was as of the date of the indictment.
That's right. You'd get an acquittal if there were a legal sufficiency. You get an appellate acquittal if there were a legal sufficiency problem. We generally don't do them on habeas, even in innocence cases. But I don't know of anybody that's actually been retried after a finding of actual innocence. I don't know that there's a bar to it, but it hasn't happened as far as I know.
It seems like that would be a tough one as a prosecutor to commit the resources to that.
Yeah, that's right.
How is your role as supervising attorney? How's that different than what you were doing before, or is it very different?
I carry the same caseload as everybody else, but I'm a liaison, I suppose, between the executive assistants and the clerks. We say it downstairs because we're upstairs from them. The clerks in the clerk's office, the chambers, and general counsel, I'm sort of the point person who does the communicating. If that's what's necessary, I help develop policies. We went remote. I collaborated with the clerks and the general counsel and the judges to sort of figure that out. And I do things like this. An official part of the role is public education, because writs are so esoteric. So few lawyers know about them. I do a lot of teaching. That's one of the best parts about my job, is getting to do a lot of lecturing. And I'm a resource for prosecutors and defense lawyers. We encourage communication if that's necessary and appropriate. We try not to do ex parte things. We try to avoid talking about the substance of anything. But if you've got a sticky procedural problem, then we try and point people in the right direction as best we can. Sometimes I get calls from a prisoner's families, and I try to deal with that in the best way that I can. So I'm sort of the public face of the writ section. I'm the prima donna who wants to do that. Most of them are happy to just work their cases. That's part of the job description for a lot of people who work on court staff. They're happy to be on court staff for a reason. They like the anonymity. They like the quiet. But I'm sort of the go-between between all of those parties, the different components of the court, and the public, to the extent that that's desirable. So it's an interesting job, and it's sort of unique in Texas law. I've had a few predecessors. Mike Stauffacher was in the office for a long time. He did a lot of CLE lecturing. A lot of people know him. Angela Moore is now a defense lawyer in the Hill Country. And John Jasuda filled the role from the late 70s all the way into the 21st century. He's sort of a legendary figure in Austin. There's sort of this secret world of Austin bureaucracy, you know, where people at the governor's clemency office. And so it's a unique role in the criminal justice system, and I'm pretty lucky to have it.
Really cool. And I think I'm right in your description that none of this goes on in the middle courts and the intermediate courts, right? This just skips straight over and goes straight to you.
The post-conviction habeas corpus goes straight to us. Mandamus is like the Texas Supreme Court. And in fact, I think we stole the idea from the Texas Supreme Court. You need to go to the appellate courts when they have concurrent jurisdiction. You can come to the Court of Criminal Appeals if you've got a good reason and skip the appellate courts, but you've got to make that case. The case, well, it doesn't matter. It's Padilla versus McDaniel, but I think that we copped that idea from the Texas Supreme Court, who had done it 10 years earlier. So if you've got a mandamus against a district judge or a county judge, then you need to exhaust that in the appellate court before you come to us. But other than that, the 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 1107 habeas corpus writs go to the trial court, the district court, and they come straight to us. And so the appellate court doesn't play a role in that.
You're in sort of a unique seat, I think, for a lot of lawyers at courts, because you probably see more than just about anybody else, pro se type writing and advocacy. I mean, what are things that you've seen in your role that you think are good advocacy, bad advocacy, things you'd want people to know who are taking on writ work, or just appellate advocacy in general?
I think a lot of the broader lessons of appellate advocacy are applicable. You want to focus on a few good grounds. You don't want to raise everything known to man. Prisoners do that a lot. I don't blame them. They might raise 20, 25 grounds in a writ, and it's basically saying the same thing over and over again in different ways, and that's fine. But if you're going to be a top gun appellate advocate, you've got to focus on a few good issues. You've got to keep it simple. You've got to be direct. You got to confront bad cases. You've got to confront burdens that you have that you may not like. For instance, you get one, in the cases we say, you get one bite at the apple. If you get one chance to challenge your conviction, after that, you can keep on filing writs, but you've got to have something newly available. You've got to satisfy a statutory bar on consideration of those. So if you're a lawyer who's doing that, you've got to confront that. A lot of people pretend like it doesn't exist. We're not going to miss it. You got to face the bad facts. And writ practice is, I don't know if it's truly a paradox. I didn't go to graduate school for philosophy, as it turns out. But it's a weird deal where you have to know a huge ocean of law to investigate one of these things, to research one of them, to file one of them. But the actual resolution of the issues usually comes down to a simple legal test. Did trial counsel err? Was that error harmful? So when it boils down to the key issues, it's really simple. So you can't spend a lot of time telling us about the 30-year history of Strickland versus Washington, which is the leading ineffective assistance of counsel case from 1984. We don't need a treatise on that. We need you to get down to the basics and show us that the lawyer messed up, and most importantly, that it's harmful. That's the number one thing that lawyers don't do. And this is probably true on the civil side too. They don't grapple with harm, and you have to. Strickland even says, we know that a lot of these cases are going to be easier to dispose of on harm. If you can do that, then we don't even care if the lawyer erred. We can say, let's assume that they did. Who cares? Does it make a difference? Do you meet your burdens? So you've got to know your burdens. You've got to face them, and you've got to plead them. You've got to make out your case. A lot of people spend a lot of time showing us how lazy and incompetent this lawyer was, how they botched the case in this way and that way, and what a bad guy or lady the lawyer was. And that's fine. Sometimes that's the case. Sometimes they really are plea artists. Sometimes they really don't know what they're doing. But ultimately, you've got to deliver on harm. And so that's the biggest deficiency that I see from lawyers. Also, and this is super simple, you got to read the rules of appellate procedure. And not only that, but you've got to understand what rules apply to what. So for instance, Rule of Appellate Procedure 52 in all of its subdivisions, I think I'm getting this right, this is for extraordinary writs, that applies to the appellate courts and the Supreme Court. It doesn't apply to the Court of Criminal Appeals. You've got to know these things. But people cite all these, or they'll cite Rule 30 or something that applies to direct appeals. You've got to understand that different parts of the traps apply to different proceedings. And so you'd be surprised, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, how people don't consult. When I was a lawyer, I was so scared. I reread those things every time I did anything. I'm shocked to know that other people don't. It just blows my mind, but they don't. So know the rules and establish harm, especially in writs. You've got to focus on that, because if you don't, it's not going anywhere. And that's an easy way for us to move the case from here to there. Part of our job is we are bureaucrats. We are moving paper. We do have a heavy docket of our own. We're trying to move these things. And if there's an easy way to move it, it's within the law, we're going to do that. And so that's an easy thing. Maybe lawyers don't grapple with harm because it's hard. I understand that. But you can't win without it.
What do you have to show in a criminal writ? Like, what is the harm that you have to show standard?
It's not a but-for test, but it's a reasonable probability that there would have been a different result, basically. And it's funny, it's one of those mind twisters where you have to prove your claims by preponderance of the evidence, but then you've got this reasonable probability. So that's something that you've got to wrestle with. On actual innocence claims, it's a clear and convincing burden, and you have to show, I think, that no rational juror would have convicted but for the newly discovered evidence of innocence or whatever it is. But it's usually a reasonable probability. People do win. Lots of people don't, but it's not insurmountable. A lot of lawyers think it is, and I understand why they do. But people do win, and prisoners win on their own without help. So it's not something that's impossible. It's just hard. It is hard. And there's a reason for that.
Sure.
The judges want some finality. And now with changing science, that's been a challenge to the criminal courts, where you have this evolving science. What happens on a case from 1985? We had an arson case where the arson science has changed dramatically since the 80s. And it was a little alarming to me. I remember the 80s very well. But apparently all the entirety of the science was setting up, and I think insurance companies do this. They set up these dummy rooms with furniture and light them on fire and videotape it. But it doesn't seem like high-tech DNA stuff, but that was what it was. And so what do you do with these? Is there ever finality in the criminal courts now? It's something that the judges wrestle with.
I think we've heard about that case before here on our podcast.
There's a few of them. Yeah.
Well, we're getting close to wrapping up. We have a couple more questions for you, though, Michael. I think one thing we'd like to know is one or more things that either lawyers or just the general public don't know about the Court of Criminal Appeals and what goes on at that court.
I think that they don't know about the mandatory docket. They probably don't know about the judges, but I don't think that that's much different from the Texas Supreme Court. But I think that they don't know the tremendous volume of issues that the court deals with. I think that a lot of judges are caught by surprise themselves when they get on the court. We've had judges who have served as trial lawyers or prosecutors, district court judges, appellate court judges, they've gone right up through the ranks and they get to the Court of Criminal Appeals and it feels like they're drinking out of a fire hose. So it does a tremendous amount of work. It's an interesting institution. I'm sort of take a minor sort of vocational interest in it just from the personalities that I've known that have worked there. It's sort of a secret Texas. It's not to the extent of maybe the Railroad Commission, but it's one of those Texas agencies where a huge volume of business goes. It has this unique, rich, long history. A lot of great judges, even in my life from the 80s and 90s. And only a small group of criminal practitioners really knows much about it. And of course, prisoners know a lot about it because we get all kinds of letters and mail from them addressed to the judges. But I think that there's an interesting sort of buried history there. The criminal bar hasn't done the same job of undertaking research into that history and sort of preserving that history that the civil bar does. I know that the appellate advocate that came out today, well, I don't know when this will actually air, but the new appellate advocate has all these interviews with appellate court judges. It would be really cool if somebody, you know, we just lost presiding Judge Onion a year or two ago, who is a titan in the Texas criminal law. There are a lot of guys and some ladies too with interesting stories to tell. And there's this whole underground legends that nobody knows about except people who have been there. And so it's an interesting place. And most people don't know that it exists, really. I mean, you might have gotten a lesson in seventh grade Texas history that Texas has two high courts, but maybe you didn't.
Well, we're coming to the end of the time we had scheduled today, Michael. This has been fascinating.
It has been. I love learning this stuff.
Yeah. You will not be the last guest on the show that we have to talk about criminal related stuff. But as you know, from being a loyal listener, we like to ask our guests at the end of each episode to offer up a tip or a war story for our listeners. So did you come prepared with one today?
You know, I thought about this and I have some wild and crazy stories from the prisons, but I probably shouldn't really tell them for various reasons. You see all kinds of things. One of the crimes that we defended is called chunking. And that is where prisoners throw bodily fluids on guard. That's a third degree assault. So, I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg. There's lots of wild stuff that goes on in prisons that nobody would know about that I'd love to talk about, but it doesn't seem appropriate. What I would say is do something that I never, ever would have considered doing when I was a lawyer. And I only practiced for 4 years or so before I came to the court. But people, it's sort of a corollary of the rule of being nice to clerks and other people in the courthouse. I mean, that's a standard that everybody hears and it's absolutely the truth. But beyond being nice to people, the non-judges, get to know, if you're practicing in an appellate court or a high court on a regular basis, get to know the staff as best you can. Get to know the clerks. Maybe there's a certain clerk that deals with this kind of proceeding and a certain clerk that deals with that kind of proceeding. Call those people. Get to know them. If the lawyers are approachable and if they're open to talking, probably the clerk at the Texas Supreme Court is a great reference. He's on Twitter, and I don't know to what degree he talks to lawyers on the phone, but get to know the people at the courts that you're dealing with regularly. I would have never dreamed of calling an appellate court and talking to somebody about something. Maybe I was too timid, but we're here to help as best we can. And there's a lot of times that a lot of anxiety and a lot of problems could be cut off at the pass if you just ask somebody something. So I encourage you. And if they say, we don't talk to lawyers, well, you know, okay, thank you. Sorry to bother you, whatever. But I haven't had that happen. People are generally nice and they generally want to help. And so I take them up on that. That's my advice.
Well, that's great advice. And we appreciate you offering it up, Michael. It's been great.
We do. Absolutely. And all of this.
Great chatting with you today. And like I said, we enjoy hearing about this kind of subject because it's so different than what we see day in and day out in our practices. So we appreciate you spending the time with us.
I'm happy to be here. It was good fun.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.